Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey, welcome to the 101st episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, storytelling, and directing. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enloe.
Today we have Julia Prescott on the show. She is a writer, showrunner. She was the showrunner on Matt's show, Townies, that he did for Black Pills and Adaptive. So you guys should check it out. It's a really fun, funny conversation. She is like definitely one of our funnier guests, I would say.
Well, I should think so. She's a stand-up comic.
She's a stand-up comic, and she hosts her own podcast called Everything's Coming Up Simpsons, where they discuss the best Simpsons episodes with various comedians and celebrities.
Yeah, so this is a great jam-packed episode. Besides showrunning Townies, Julia also is a lecturer on filmmaking in her own right, and also a screenwriting teacher, so she's just filled with insight. Really funny anecdotes. It's a total delight. So if you are interested in writing for animation, if you're interested in learning more about screenwriting, showrunning for the first time, all of that stuff is in this episode. And it's just a really nice time.
Well, so before we talk to her, we were going to read some iTunes reviews real quick.
Hey, hey, thanks everybody.
We have a review from Seth Juergen, who was at our live show.
Shout out, Seth. Hey, Seth drove all the way down from Fresno to come to the live show. So special thank you to Seth. And he left us a review.
Yeah, he says, looking for your one-stop filmmaking resource shop? Look no further. From commercial directing to moving to LA, this podcast is a cornucopia of delicious information nuggets. Mm. As an aspiring writer and director, Oren and Matt's podcast has not only been incredibly entertaining, but the information from one particular episode, episode 81, Everything About Making Commercials, helped me on my first commercial directing gig. Wowee. Talk about a practical application. I mostly just want to hear you guys say wowee on the air.
Hey, anyway, you nailed it.
Thank you.
Wowee.
If that hasn't convinced you to give it a listen, then I don't know what will. Keep up the good work, guys. It's inspiring.
Hey,
Seth Juergen.
Thanks for that, Seth. And congrats on the commercial gig.
Yeah, and we'll Google you. Sethyergin. We'll see what you're working on.
Yeah, buddy.
And then we also have a review from Richard Botto. He says, Matt and Oren, keep up the great work for all of us filmmakers who are navigating this industry. We at Stage 32 love that you bring in people who are doing it now, and it's our same mission to help encourage and support fellow creatives. Bravo, guys. So Stage 32 is a company, it's a social networking site for creatives, artists, people in film industry stuff. So check it out. Thanks, Richard Botto. This is, by the way, not a sponsorship or anything. It's an iTunes review, so we're excited to check it out. If you guys want us to read your review out loud, want to plug your short film, your Kickstarter campaign, anything, leave us a review and we'll read it on the podcast.
And which reminds me, Oren,
yes,
do you remember a few episodes ago?
Oh, yeah. Let's not talk about this now. We're running out of time. This episode's already running long. But I will address your question.
You salty dog, you.
On the next episode.
We sat down with our friend Cameron from Film Casualty to talk a little bit more about the ins and outs of insurance and how the fine folks at Film Casualty could help us out.
All right, I'm going to
set up a scenario for you.
So a few filmmakers and I, we just bought a camera, some lighting gear. We pooled our cash. How do we get insured? Can we keep it at one of our houses? Do we have to be specific about where that is? And what's kind of the minimum value of camera gear that we should bother insuring in the first place?
No matter the size of your role on a set or the size of your film business, Film Casualty has solutions for you. If you are a new filmmaker just starting out, go to filmcasualty.com and hit our application. It's incredibly easy to fill out, and it provides a lot of information that we need to get great insurance proposals for filmmakers very, very quickly. If you're a new filmmaker just starting out with your friends and you have gear and you're trying to figure out what to do, we can offer solutions, everything from general liability to property coverage, workers' comp, kind of across the board.
Say I bought a Red Weapon and some lenses. I've spent like $80,000. Is that an amount of investment into equipment that I should get insured?
Yeah, totally. I would actually recommend an inland marine coverage on the Red Dragon or any expensive piece of specific film gear that you have. If we know the cost of replacement, then we can insure against that directly. And in the event of some sort of peril occurring, we can get it covered.
For more information about how to protect your film business, gear, project, and crew, go to filmcasualty.com/justshootit. That's filmcasualty.com/justshootit. Insurance for every kind of filmmaker. Hello, hello, Julia Prescott on the mic.
Yeah.
Welcome. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys?
So good. I'm on the drive over, I was thinking about how excited I am to have you on the show.
Oh, man. You're so sweet.
Such a delight.
Matt, I was stoked to see you. It's been a minute.
Yeah, it has been, right?
Yeah, he's been talking about this. He's like, you're going to love Julia.
Oh, so no. Now the bar has been impossibly raised.
Yeah, he's like, she's so great. So you created Townies,
mm-hmm.
the show that Matt directed.
Yes.
For Adaptive Studios.
And,
and Black Pills.
Mm-hmm.
By the time this is airing, people should be able to see some, if not all, of the series by now.
Mm-hmm. On Black Pills?
Yeah.
On Black Pills. Yeah, we'll have links in the show notes, everyone.
Ooh. And I've changed my Twitter header to be the still Ooh, from Townies. I've good. Done that. I was like, I'll do this.
Yeah, good.
Sure, why not?
Get into it.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
Townies is a Western, like, raunchy high school comedy.
Yeah, I always called it the OC in the Old West. So it's the untold story of the crazy, sexy teens of the Pioneer era. Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, I know there's... Shit. There's something that's like super like wacky about that, but there is also something like a little profound, which you're like, I didn't really think about teen life in the old
right?
West, right?
Yeah.
You're like, that's kind of, it must have existed.
It existed for just a millisecond, you know? Like, that's the joke where it's like, they go from age 14 to like hardened, like grizzled Clint Eastwood in just a second. So we catch them in that little in between.
Did people get married like in the 1880s when they were like 14 and 15?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think the joke is based in a real reality where like teenagers weren't really invented in the sense that we understand them until like the 50s, right? Like you had to have disposable income and like a longer education path and not get married when you were 14.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, once you have your bar mitzvah, your parents assign you your wives.
Mm-hmm.
And you
sometimes earlier
kids.
Than that, you just you go for it.
Yeah,
man, we didn't do an Old West bar mitzvah. Season two
will have the musical episode, the Paint Your Wagon.
Did you do like a Sweet 16, or is that too old?
No.
Well,
a quinceanera, 15.
There was a birthday in the first episode where we kind of demonstrated that the quick transition from babyface to full on Clint Eastwood. But it's funny because like. I wrote the whole series by myself, and I went through a bunch of different passes from like outline to scripts, and I had to cut so much. Like, I think the first outline that I delivered for 6 10-minute episodes was like 28 pages long.
The outline.
Just the outline. And all the people, the good people at Adaptive, like really laid into me on that one, that I just basically wrote a movie. But I think... Like, I'm trying to remember, there were so many moments that were cut that were, like, basically the school dance or, you know, a bar mitzvah type thing. You know, a lot of, like, parent-kid, like, heart-to-heart after-school special moments that were completely cut out. Like, there's no parents in the show at all now. And so,
which I love, actually.
Yeah. It was nice. It had a good vibe overall, like in the end, because it was kind of their show and the parents were irrelevant.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry, just to jump deep right at the beginning, but when you write your outlines, do you include any dialogue? Do you have slug lines? Like, what's your kind of format?
Yeah. Usually for me, when I'm just writing my own, I'll kind of like have them be sort of outline slash beat sheety kind of stuff. So because my beat sheets always kind of morph into outlines. Mm-hmm. As I've mentioned, I overwrite.
What's a beat sheet versus an outline?
Oh, a beat sheet is really just like the most consolidated, efficient way of writing all of like the different parts of the story. So the cold open would probably be like one sentence or one or two sentences, and then each scene would just be like, and then this happens and this happens. It's just like the bare bones story beats of what I want to accomplish.
Without just like any of the comedy. I mean, I guess the situations are funny.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
No jokes.
Yeah, I'm not a ton of jokes. I mean, good Lord. not a ton of jokes, just because, especially if you're writing to deliver to a studio or you're working on a job, you don't want to include too many jokes or too many things that could be distracting or mm-hmm. get noted.
You don't want to slow them down.
Yeah. Yeah. You just want to like give them like, all right, this is a story about, you know, like going to the hangman competition in townies. And so she does this and then this and then this and then this. And it's just like, you know, bare bones, like as if you could, you know, say it Aaron Sorkin style walking down a hallway and then right. get the full episode.
But do you care about tone at all? Like, are you trying to communicate the tone in that beat sheet?
Not so much in the beat sheet, but in the outline, absolutely, mm-hmm. with the tone. And that's where you can kind of include some of the jokes and some of the other things. When I'm writing just for my own stuff, I'll write as much as I can in the outline and really overwrite, because then when you transition from going, outline to script, it becomes a really easy process. You can kind of work out all of like the story holes that, you know, you could get tripped up in if you were to just go to final draft. You know, can look at it in this Word document, and for some reason it has like less pressure. Mm-hmm. So it just feels like, you know, not for real writing. So you're just kind of like, you know, doodling with the characters and the story beats. But yeah, my outlines will include like slug lines of where we're at. Sometimes if I'm feeling fancy, I'll even include underneath the slug line all of the characters that are in the scene italicized, so I can just look at it and go, okay, cool, here's where we're at, and then I'll write what happens and it'll be like a paragraph, and then I'll move on and do act breaks and stuff like that.
In Word?
Yeah, I'll just do that in Word.
I've started doing that sort of work in Highland. Have you ever played with Highland?
Yeah.
So normally I use it just to like, it melts PDFs into final draft files, which is super nice. But the other thing it does is it'll let you toggle in between just like basically a regular basic text edit program.
Oh,
so
cool.
Like you can kind of just do basic standard Word processing. And it's got a tiny little bit of formatting markup that basically lets it translate into a final draft file.
Oh,
so
cool.
It, you know, it takes a tiny little bit of learning to kind of figure mm-hmm. out all of the coding, but like it's pretty streamlined. And so you can kind of save yourself a tiny bit of work in mm-hmm. translating your slugs, for instance, from
right,
your outline
right.
into your...
Yeah. And I've known some people that have like, they'll write their outlines in a Word doc and then they'll just copy and paste it and put it into a final draft just to sort of see how long that's going to be and to mm-hmm. kind of like generally gauge. And then some people are even crazier where they'll like just write the script around the outline. Mm-hmm. I don't like that.
I worked with
like
a guy,
fresh start.
Yeah. I worked with a guy that did his outlines in final draft. Like he'd write the slug line, then what happens in the scene, slug uh-huh. line. And then he would like slowly morph mm-hmm. it into a script.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people are using Google Docs now because they're annoying.
Right. We use that at work. I find a lot of workplaces will use Google Docs just because the formatting is like pretty accurate for mm-hmm. one page is one page, and there's not a lot of like, you know, variety with like headers of like 1 inch or whatever. But then also sharing, just the shareability of it is really nice. But I've actually started with my pitch docs. I'm working on a script right now that like I've been struggling to write as a pilot for a really long time. And I've seen this a couple times, so I'm exploring it with this idea where like I wrote the cold open that I feel pretty good about it, but then I'm writing the rest of the pitch in final draft as well. And as I'm writing the pitch, you know, I'll say like this character is like this and they do this and that. And then I'll just write a quick scene to sort of expand on that mm-hmm. and then like go back to the pitch and then do that. I've seen it a couple times. It's not standard, but I think for this particular idea, it works. And I think that's okay. I don't know, to kind of like change your method per idea.
I will do a similar sort of thing where I'll throw in kind of the backwards version of it, where I'll be in Google Docs and then I'll format something like a screenplay real quick. So mm-hmm. if I want to do, like if you're, the fastest and best way to illustrate the dialogue style between two characters is just to like write a quick funny scene to just right. have in there.
Yeah.
So that's what you're describing, right? But kind of final draft rather than.
But Google yeah, Docs, in yeah. final draft. And for me, I just feel like whatever's going to convey the idea that you want the best, mm-hmm. just go with that. Like there is no standard. And it took me a really long time to kind of detach myself from that like school mentality mm-hmm. of like, this is the only way to format a script or this is the only way to do this. And just sort of off-road in my own way, because when you pitch something or when you submit a script to somebody, of course, if they ask for a pilot script, send them a pilot script. Don't send it to them in a Word doc. You know, there are those certain rules, but when you're pitching, especially, there are no rules, yeah. you know, but yeah, it's just like whatever conveys the idea best. And right. when I'm even like writing my action headings in my own scripts, I'll like curse, I'll talk to myself, I'll do all these random things, just whatever works for conveying that idea. And I think that also kind of feeds into my tone and my voice and yeah, 100%. Makes it mine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember when I first got the Townie scripts, they're great. I love them.
Aw, thanks.
Right. So much fun. And I think the benefit of you having overwritten so much before is that like everything is super duper dense. Right. Mm-hmm. So like, and you have a reason for why all of the characters are doing the things that they're doing, even if it doesn't necessarily inform the story anymore. The homework has been done. But I before Townies, used to be a real stickler about like, if you can't shoot it, it shouldn't be on the page.
Mm.
And that's still a generally true thing that I believe in. But I think that you get away with throwing jokes into scene description because it does such a good job of A, being genuinely funny, which is oftentimes the thing I'm actually complaining about.
Mm-hmm.
And then B, conveying tone, right?
Yeah.
So I understand how to shoot your show better because the jokes in scene description are evoke that sort of style and idea.
Oh, cool. Great. Yeah.
So
I'm glad it worked.
I was like, well, I can back off on this one because normally I'm like, right. you know, like,
tone is so hard. Yeah. I feel like I really fixate on that a lot. And you know, that can like also paralyze you in mm-hmm. a way because tone is also so slippery. It's sort of like when people talk about finding your voice as a comedian and finding your voice as a writer. It's not like you wake up one day and you know what your voice is and that's what it is. You kind of have to wait for the universe to tell you what mm-hmm. your voice is and to kind of point out little characteristics and make you go, oh yeah, I do like to do this one thing, or oh yeah, that is like a trend, you know, across different scripts that I like to explore themes right. of this, that, you know, whatever.
You notice patterns later on. Yeah, mm-hmm. interesting.
Yeah. yeah. As far as like, you know, the tone in my action headings and like that kind of stuff, I just want people to know exactly what the fuck kind of world we're in and exactly who the fuck these characters are and like just, you know, what makes them tick in that small, tiny way.
There is a moment in Townies where the main character has like a real emotional breakdown. And this is, you know, there's emotional truth in the show, but it's not drama by any mm-hmm. means, right? And I think the line is that the character will give a performance that will make Meryl Streep's anus clench.
That was written in the action headings.
Yeah, yeah. It's a professional script and we're professionals shooting this professional
yeah,
show.
Yeah, I mean, I delight in stuff like that. I think that also comes from, because I went to film school, I went to Chapman, and though I didn't major in screenwriting, I majored in film studies, and you know, that was kind of like adjacent to it.
I took screenwriting courses as well, actually.
Were you really? Yeah. Were we talking about this?
No. I'm from Orange County. That's what I got.
Hey, hey. So you were there too.
Yeah, it's probably next to you.
Yeah.
Peeking over the fence. Cool. George Lucas installed fence.
You're better off because now I owe them so much money, and I wish I did
so
not.
So much money.
But I just remember like struggling so much with trying to convey exactly what I wanted the scene to be. Like I could see it so visually. I was always the kid that all of like my journals in high school were actually sketchbooks because I would like write. And then I would just draw like mm-hmm. I'd use them as like storyboards because I kind of tinkered with filmmaking at that level, you know, whatever that is. You guys sure. all know what I'm talking about sure. being a teenage filmmaker. And so often I was just like, I can see it in my head. Why can't I just like not have it be a full paragraph of description? Right. And I just found that like not mincing words and just being like, yeah, it's to a performance that would make Meryl Streep's anus clench. Like, there it
got
is.
It. Next.
Don't need you don't need an extra sentence. We all know what that is.
Right.
And also, if I can make, you know, this person laugh as they're reading it and go like, this writer is having fun, then I've done my job, I think.
Right.
And is that something, so a line like that in a script, which is obviously great, like, is that, that's just like the thought process that you're is in your head, or do you write like, oh, it's a, you know, a great performance, and then as you're like kind of rewriting your script, are you like, oh, this it's so great, like you're starting to add color
to
your
was,
description as you go rewrite.
That was a first draft.
I am jealous. I can't tell you how many times I'm like, I need to make just reading this more fun.
Really?
Yeah. I do a color pass at the end.
No, for sure. And like run on sentences and getting rid of like a bunch of repeating words. And
Yeah.
Well, it, you know, depending on like the tone of the story I'm telling, this one was definitely more like, we're having fun here.
Right.
You know, I would reference Wet Hot American Summer and those kind of comedies a lot, which always just felt like a group of people having fun that really enjoyed each other. I would write, my like character descriptions and my action like I was just talking to my friend.
Right.
And kind of come at it from there. And I find that that's slightly more successful than, say, my previous attempts of like writing as if I'm, you know, handing it off to the CEO of NBC, you know,
right.
Like no one really wants, it's always going to be dry when you get into that mindset with it. And that was a lesson that I had to learn, you know, over many years of like finally kind of breaking down why I write and what I want to write. And that if it's, you know, maybe I don't want to write a spec of the Mindy Project and I don't want it to feel like that. I just want to write, you know, what makes me laugh.
Right.
And that's sort of where I landed.
Let me ask you, Matt, when you see a script or in the scene description, it's like, this performance is so amazing, it would make Meryl Streep's anus clench. Or does that stress you out a little bit? Like, oh, how are we going to get our actor to be better than Meryl Streep?
Because it's tongue-in-cheek, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think I wasn't worried about it in that it wasn't setting any sort of pressure beyond like, this is kind of like a funny way of dealing with an emotional scene.
Mm-hmm,
you know, so so it, in that way, I didn't feel like there was a ton of pressure or anything like that. Honestly, like when I read that script, most of it was like, oh, no, there's no fat to cut. And we had to.
Yeah.
That was the thing that was stressing me out for sure.
But we figured it out.
We figured it out.
We're fucking wizards, I think. That's like my proudest moment that we actually made a stupid show at the end of that.
it was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So just to kind of back up a tiny bit for people who don't listen super regularly, because I've talked about the show a decent amount, or Tony's a decent amount on this show, but basically we were out in the Mojave Desert.
Mm-hmm.
How hot did it get?
It was up to 110, all the time.
I clocked 115 some days.
Yeah, when Julia first walked in the door, she was like, you look different. And I was like, yeah, I'm not drenched in sweat.
You're not glistening.
We were all Mad Max in it out there. We really were,
yeah,
you know, just not giving a shit, dirt all over our faces.
Yeah, just disgusting. But we shot for 8 days, 7 days?
I feel like 8 or 9, actually.
Yeah.
But I wasn't there for a couple.
You know, also we had the we called it the siesta schedule, where we would shoot basically from sunrise to lunch and then go take a 3-hour break and then shoot from then till sundown. And so it kind of felt like 2 days each time.
And how many pages?
Yeah, that's a question for you, actually.
And in the end, total?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it was 60 in the end. But then when we were shooting, an average size day was like 10 to 11 pages.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was crazy.
That first day, and that may make sense because you weren't there that first day because you had a job that we'll get to where you were writing with awesome people and having a great time. We just weren't used to the heat yet. And I think we only made like 4 or 5 pages that first day. And it was like, we had a real come to Jesus moment of like, oh no, like I know how fast I can shoot. And I had just come off a mockumentary series where we were hosing things down. I shot 16 pages in one day.
Oh, wow.
Not without breaking a sweat, but it was, this was hard. This was hard in a way that other show was hard in different ways. So it was a real challenge. And we kind of walked in knowing that we needed to trim things a little bit and that we would find some stuff on set. And I think that I remember very clearly that first day that you had arrived, and you were like, oh, I see.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, here we go.
Yeah, there was a lot of reality checks every moment.
And there were just like, you know, a metaphorical bucket of dead puppies at your feet, basically.
Yeah. It was like the biggest learning experience I've ever had, the most rewarding, really, of like how to... I thought I had already written pretty efficiently.
You had.
I had. But then to like, I haven't been on a lot of live action sets, so mm-hmm. I wasn't super familiar with that. But, you know, coming out of it, like turning to you during the process and being like, okay, you know what? I don't think this person needs to be in this scene.
Yeah.
Like, let's figure that out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and just rewriting what seemed like every day.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think ultimately, I think just some characters... stories got trimmed pretty significantly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like that was the difference. We weren't cutting fat, we were cutting content, basically.
Yeah, yeah. There were a couple, like our town mortician, Dave Child, I feel like he had maybe at least 1.5 scenes that we had to cut down.
Real good scenes, yeah.
Really good scenes, you know. So we were just like cutting jokes at the end, but
that was your character arc for me, actually. Because I remember there was the first time you were like, I cut some stuff, and I was like, great. And like we looked at it and we realized, oh, it's like, oh, like about 1.5 pages. And mm-hmm. I remember I had a real hard, like a Scooby-Doo, like gulp. Like, we still got to do a lot more.
Right.
And then I remember Dave, who is like a dear friend of yours and mm-hmm. an incredibly talented performer who had been up in the fucking desert with us for
right,
a week.
Right, I know.
In like a mortician's outfit.
Ay-ay-ay.
And like gross makeup and all this stuff. And you were like, sorry, dude, you're cut.
It was like, I mean, it, thank God it was him though, and
yeah, that's
and
true.
You know that we had had that relationship, and also like he you know is the kind of guy that was just like, I'm having a great time.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact that I'm in this for a second feels right, you know. He was in really good spirits about it. But yeah, there were a couple times where he was like about to get on the van and I was like, sorry, dude, like get back in the hotel, like get another omelet.
Yeah.
You're not in this scene. So yeah, he was a good sport about it. And I got paid a pretty nice compliment from our adaptive people about, you know, changes on the fly. They told me that they'd been on a couple sets where they would tell like the writer director, hey, you need to cut like half a scene or something. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even like a huge thing. And they would start crying, like get really emotional about it. And, you know, when they told me that, I was like, oh, I mean, it was a job that needed to get done.
Yeah.
I mean, I was upset, of course.
Sure,
I was stressed out. Like every dinner, I was like, what are we going to do? But I remember turning to you throughout the process and going, well, are we still going to have a show?
Yeah.
Like, as long as we still have a story, that's all I cared about. And, you know, it would have been nice to have those extra moments with Dave and some other extra jokes and stuff like that. But as long as we had that story arc that I had worked hard to write, you know, that was good by me.
Well, do you think if you had to do it all over again, you would write less?
I don't know, though, because I don't know if I could have anticipated it, and I think that it was okay that we were ambitious.
Yeah, I don't think anyone can know until they're in it in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
right? Because we didn't know how hard it was gonna be. Certainly I didn't know what our actual page count was gonna be
mm-hmm.
until
I mean
we
when
were
you
in it.
Before you went to shoot Townies, which was already insane because it was like a week after you just finished this giant shoot,
right?
Yeah.
But you had were already talking about like, oh, this is the size of the show. And I was like, how long do you have to shoot that? Like a month? And you're like, no, like a week.
Yeah.
If the heat hadn't been such a factor, I think we would have shot a minimum of 3 more pages.
Yeah.
Per day.
I was
No. Just total across the board. Because we still hit some high page counts.
Yeah.
Well, one day in a flash flood.
I'm going to say, I do not believe in God. But he was shining on us a couple moments in like there were, you know, just like one hit wonder kind of shots that we got, action shots too, that one day during the flash flood where we turned and there was this beautiful like heavenly opening.
Yeah,
of
we had the God rays during a very emotional scene.
Yeah. So we were like, fucking perfect. Let's do this. But I was going to say that, you know, if we had to do it all over again, I think that it's better that we, I would rather have been ambitious in the way that we were versus, you know, being too lean and having time at the end, like, oh, well, we could have done this.
Yeah.
Like, I would have rather have shot for the stars like we did.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for the first time in quite a long time, it really felt like we were at camp.
Yeah.
You know, I think I hadn't done like big long-term location stuff where everybody was staying at the same hotel. There was nothing else to do
yeah.
in a very literal sense. Like literally the town we stayed in had a hotel, motel, I should say, the diner that was attached to that motel, a Dairy Queen and a Jack in a Box and a
Subway
and two gas stations. And that was the town.
Yeah. Also, like, at any given time, 1.5 people working that diner. One guy that was, like, on his way out.
Yeah, yeah.
They got lasted back in yeah. when we stormed in. Yeah, it was a really great bonding experience. And I was really tickled by how well our cast bonded. I mean, some of them knew each
yeah.
other before, but they really bonded.
Yeah.
So that was, like, a good little, like, oh, we're making a real show. And
yeah.
this is a special thing.
Yeah, it was a blast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I've heard enough about how much fun that was. It's not that interesting to me. So what's your other job? What's your day job?
I'm currently writing on a show for DreamWorks that has not been announced, so I'm not allowed to mention. Yeah.
An animated show?
An animated show, yeah. But I've been doing that. I'm a staff writer. I've been doing that since June, and it's been a lot of fun. Before this, I was freelancing Fancy Free. I would freelance on different shows for different networks, but nothing, you know, as corporate and every day as this. So it's been a bit of an adjustment. But yeah, DreamWorks is a nice company to work for. They give you free lunch. They you know, want to make a bunch of fun things happen. So
where's the office?
In Glendale. Yeah.
Like at the DreamWorks? Do they have like a campus or something?
Yeah, they have two campuses. There's the big fancy one that we are not on. That's where all the movies are and stuff like that. And then there's like basically the TV campus that's a couple miles away. And we are right near the Americana.
Ooh, so, at Brand?
Yeah,
on Love it.
Brand.
You know what?
Kind of in and out.
They take Movie Pass. So, and that movie theater is
You're
big.
On Movie Pass?
Yeah.
It's changed our lives.
Yeah.
I've seen every movie.
Yeah, it's the best, right?
Yeah.
So have you written a lot of animation before?
Yeah, I've written on shows for Disney. I wrote on a show called Future Worm, which is really fun. It was
slimy.
About, yeah, it was like sci-fi. James Adomian was in it, as
oh,
was
cool.
Andy Milonakis. And it was about a boy who has a time machine lunchbox and his best friend is a worm from the future, which
James
voiced. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And Andy was the kid. So that was super fun. Unfortunately, it only lasted 2 seasons on Disney, but I wrote for the first season. And then I've written on Cartoon Network for a bunch of different stuff. I'm actually freelancing on a show for them right now that I also think hasn't been announced. So why do I bring it up? But I've written on animation stuff, but also some live action stuff, of course, Townies, and then Screen Junkie stuff, other random comedy bullshit.
I want to talk actually about, because you do, you're part of the Nerd Melt lecture series.
Yeah.
But you also teach you have a writing group, the Vomit Draft thing.
Yeah, the Trash Draft.
Trash Draft. Thank
workshop.
You. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we talked about this a little bit in Townies, but walk us through the Trash Draft workshop and
yes.
what that is and how that works.
It began as a writing group that I formed with my friends, and it was just like 5 of us. I think I formed it like 2 or 3 years ago. It was right around the holidays, you know, when you get really itchy and you're thinking about how you're going to conquer the new year and you're just so frustrated. So I just wanted to, you know, have an excuse to just push out an idea. And the way Trash Draft works is we would all get together on a Saturday and we'd pitch out our ideas and then write
like
our outlines.
Like a brand new idea.
Like a brand new idea that you've never touched before. And it could be anything. I mean, we've had people over the years work on features or work on, you know, short film scripts. It's whatever you need it to be. But traditionally, in the way that I originally envisioned it, it's like writing a pilot. Brand new. So you pitch out on Saturday, and then on Sunday you presumably write your outline in the privacy of your home, and then every day leading up to the following Sunday you write. So boils down to about 5 or 6 pages a day, and then on Sunday we do read-throughs, and it's an all-day thing. We order pizza, and they're just trash drafts. So like, don't apologize. It, mm-hmm. you wrote it in a week. We all wrote it in a week, you know, let's just see. And what's come out of it is, you know, I've seen people like finish really, really strong pilots, really strong specs, you know, really strong things. I've written a couple pilots myself that I'm particularly proud of. But what's great about it, I think, is that you take the pressure off of being mm-hmm. so precious about every single page and every single, you know, bit of dialogue. And I think also, even when you kind of half write an outline, which seems to be the case because it's such a breakneck pace right. in writing it, just pushing and pushing and pushing, your mind, you've got those ideas in there mm-hmm. and you can surprise yourself. So, you know, I've done a couple trash drafts where like I kind of didn't really write an outline and did like choose your own adventure style, like just sort of opening doors and seeing where it could go. And yeah, I've written a couple pilots that like I never want to read again. but
who cares?
But
right?
who cares? Yeah. Like I honestly believe that writing, like you have a certain amount of like bad scripts in your system and you just need to chip away mm-hmm. and like get them out, get them, you know, out of your view, and then dig deeper into the better scripts. And writing the bad ones or writing the ones that are really scrappy and trashy can only lead to becoming a stronger writer.
Right.
So semi-recently, I approached Io West and asked if they wanted to, you know, feature it as like maybe a workshop or a class. And they said yes. So I've done it twice now where I would teach it in like the same kind of way. And it was really interesting to transition from it being this like cozy thing I would do in my house mm-hmm. to like, hello, students, you know, yeah. I am your
teacher. This is how you write a trash draft.
Yeah. Yeah. It was interesting. I didn't anticipate like having to also kind of explain the basics of story structure and writing a script to a
yeah.
lot of these students.
Yeah. It's not an ideal situation for your first script. Yeah.
But then we would also get people that were, you know, like familiar with it. And each time I've done it, granted, it's only been twice, I've been really surprised by the outcome.
Yeah.
You know,
the goal is not like write your first screenplay in a week.
Yeah.
It's, get over that writer's block
exactly.
or like, you know, just get this out of your system in a
yeah.
week.
Yeah. And I've known a lot of people to take writing classes where like the class was specifically set up to over the course of 6 weeks, by the end, you'll have a script in your hand that you'll be proud of. That's great. Congratulations. This is just to prove that you can do it, mm-hmm. to really shatter what causes like, you know, writer's block and what, you know, is the voice that's telling you like you'll never write past page six. And right. it's just about, you know, pushing through and like getting that sort of like creative mojo going. And oftentimes, like right now, I did a trash draft a couple weeks ago and I'm not happy with what I came out with. So right now, I'm like writing the opposite of that script. And mm-hmm. oftentimes I'll find whenever I get frustrated in one world, you know, this is like a very grounded, like it deals with death and it deals with like two sisters sort of dealing with something very serious. I'm like off-roading to the opposite, which is a very high concept cocaine time travel show.
Sure, of course.
Like you do.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
and
a lot of those.
Yeah. So it's like, I think Trash Draft maybe has helped me, you know, believe that that's okay to just sort of jump around and just do something and not judge yourself.
Right.
Just push through.
We've all wasted a week of our own time and not had a screenplay at the
absolutely.
End of it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I've probably spent quite a few years like working on reasons that I shouldn't be like writing my screenplay right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The one thing too, though, I mean, some people could make this argument against Trash Draft of like, well, then your mind can get a little too attached with how you laid out that world in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why people like spend so much time outlining, before going into script. I think that that's a cop out. And I think that when you get to that point where you go, well, maybe like this isn't the right take on it, it may very well be. That's when you send it to somebody that you trust, send it to a couple people that you trust, because no one's going to read it in the time you want them to.
Sure.
And, and then listen to that feedback and have that kind of inform the next phase of that script that you go about. But you have something. And like, I think that's, you know, really the goal. And that's way more important than people give it credit for.
Yeah.
Is there any more structure to the timeline, or at least when you do it at iOS, like, Is there like, so one day you write the outline and then you have to write 10 pages a day? Or
5 pages a day usually is the average that I've kind of rounded out. And when I do the workshop, because I'm being paid, I tend to be a little bit more like, hey guys, like I'm sending out emails like every other day, just like, you know, stay strong. I usually find, and I tell this to my students on the first day, that like Wednesday is the worst day. Wednesday is the day that you're just like, fuck. It's right. Either you run out of steam because you don't like your idea anymore and you thought you did 2 days ago, and now it's like, oh, this is actually a sketch. That happens a lot. Or you mismanaged your time and you know, life happened, or you just didn't think about it.
Right.
And so now you kind of are panicking.
You can't write 15 pages in one day, basically.
Yeah.
And you're realizing that.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And you know, for that, like, yeah, doing trash draft is really hard, but if you're going to have like one really stressful week where you don't go out every night to go hang out with your friends, you don't go to the comedy shows, you don't book them if you perform, whatever, that's okay. Like that trade-off, I think, is perfectly reasonable for having a script at the end.
Like people will go for like a week-long meditation retreat.
I know.
So why not that week and have something at the end?
Yeah.
Other than just like calm and serenity. Who needs that?
Yeah. Yeah.
May I ask how much it costs to take your trash?
Oh, at iOS, I think it's like $80 for like the week long workshop. But we meet on Saturday and Sunday.
That's like nothing.
Your dreams come true for $80.
Your dreams come true. I know, and I've actually been yelled at by, I have another friend that teaches at IO, because I always feel bad. Maybe this is like the camp counselor in me, that I'm just like, oh, I feel like people, I want to give everybody as much time as they, you know, need for feedback and notes on like the last day read through. So of course somebody gets shafted in the end, you know, because of just the way it goes. And so I always am like, you guys can email me anytime you want. Like email me scripts and I'll read them. And you know, my friend yelled at me like, you can't do that. Cause even in the room, one of the students goes, wow, this is the best $80 I've ever spent. I'm like, oh shit. But here's the thing, writers don't email. So they never follow up.
Yeah,
so
that's
it's worked out so far, but I should stop saying that.
That is a really good deal. I feel like you think of like writer's boot camp or something. It's like $600.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I'll up the price after this.
I mean, you could double it and it would still probably, right?
Yeah, I could.
I want to ask about animation for a second. Let's say we have some listeners that are interested in getting into animation, but they're not animators. How did you get into it? Are you an animator? Or?
No, I'm not, but my husband is. And my sister is. So I kind of know that world.
But you were
them.
In animation before you got married.
Yeah, right? I was writing for animation for a long time. And that came out of my first writing job just happened to be animation.
Interesting.
You sent samples out and that's the job you got?
Kind of. I started doing stand-up in college and I started kind of figuring out that I wanted to be a comedy writer, you know, around junior, senior year. And I was very fortunate when I graduated high school. I won this scholarship from Warner Brothers to go to film school. And then part of that I didn't realize was that I could go intern there every summer, which was
cool.
It changed my life.
Yeah.
The best opportunity I've ever been given. It was funny, like, the day that I won the scholarship, they were like, what are you doing this summer? And I was like, working at Cold Stone. They're like,
pretty good.
It was great. Yeah. I smelled like waffle free bowls all the time.
Super strong wrists.
I had fucking guns. And I would just walk away with like whole bags of Heath bars and just full. But anyway, I was interning at Warner Brothers and happened to meet the head of the writer's workshop there, which, you guys, the listeners, I'm saying, you probably know, but listeners, if you don't know, every studio has a writing fellowship to get people, you know, their foot in the door that wouldn't normally have that opportunity. And it's really fun for comedy writers because they normally have 10 slots and only 2 are for comedy and 8 are for drama.
Is that right?
Wow. Yeah. But anyway, it's a really great opportunity. Warner Brothers does it. Disney does it. NBC, CBS has a diversity showcase. Fox, I think, has something. Anyway, so I met him and I was like, still in college toward the end. And I remember walking into the meeting. It was just a general and him saying, right off the top, hey, so I just wanted to let you know that probably not going to let you into the writing fellowship because you are far too young. And I was like, no worries. We're just hanging out.
Right.
And over the course of about an hour, I was just talking to him about like some bullshit that I was working on, these sketches that I'd written. You know, I was starting to work in Channel 101 and make some like web series pilots. And they were just like these nothing scripts, but I just happened to have them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's always the story you hear, right? Like you just happen to have all of your packet ready to go. But I had been like kind of accidentally forming it just by exploring, you know, my own creative whims and not knowing where it would lead up. Because usually you have to have a spec or a pilot, but I just had these little scrappy things. I think one of them was called Abraham Lincoln's My Roommate and He's Kind of a Dick. And that was like the one that stuck out. You know, I got a lot of Abe Lincoln biscuit gravy jokes and him just being a slob and having loud sex and stuff like that. That was my calling card.
Giant hats, like always all over the place.
Yeah, this fucking asshole. His like mole hairs and like the fucking shower. But I think that was honestly what stood out. And so he, at the end of the conversation, was like, you know, I think actually there might be an opportunity that you might be good for. I don't know.
Wow. So you got the writing fellowship?
No, I ended up getting a staff writing job out of college at Cartoon Network. You know,
boy,
on that Mad TV show, the Mad Magazine animated show.
Oh yeah.
So that was it was a really fun experience. It was interesting because it was an animated sketch show, which they don't normally make. And the guys that ran it, this guy, Kevin Shinnick, he had just come from Robot Chicken. So they kind of ran the room like they would at Robot Chicken, which was like the hardest writer's room I've ever been a part of as far as output goes. Because every day it was me and I want to say three other writers in the room. And we were all responsible with pitching like 14 different bits every day, and they would range from like fully fledged sketches. A lot of it was like pop culture stuff. A lot of it was like Justin Bieber kind of pop culture stuff. But then there would be maybe smaller sketches that they would call mad moments. But anyway, you had to turn in basically a packet, like a one person packet every single day. And I remember by like week two, I was still living with my mom and just being like exasperated at the end of a day, like coming home at 10, just going, you don't understand, mom. It's so hard. And she was like, I'm not hearing that. You're living your dream. Yeah. Like, shut
up. Was that a writer's like WGA job?
No, it was non-union, which has been most of what I've done.
Yeah, most animation, I think.
Is. Oh, right. Yeah. Though I am part of the Animation Guild now, which is cool. Fun because I'm having healthcare for the first time.
Hey, congrats on that.
Thank you so much. I immediately went to the dentist. Thank you. It's just, I'm glowing with healthcare. but yeah, that job just, it you know, animation jobs beget other animation jobs. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, you know, that part of the industry kind of snowballs with that. And I've talked to other people that have worked in kids and animation, and it feels like, granted, I haven't done a ton of stuff for like cable or Comedy Central or whatever, but it feels like the one corner of the industry where there is consistently some kind of work happening. Like you could probably work a little bit more consistently in kids and animation than, you know, the sexier kind of cable shows, just because there's way more opportunities, way more shows in that way.
And I think like the timeline is a little bit different as well, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like, especially like those cable shows tend to have a very specific window and then you're kind of done and you have long hiatuses. Do you find that with animation or?
It's always felt like it was going by its own thing, but it's hard to track too, because the industry has changed so much just in the last 5 years, where it's a fantastic time to be a creator right now. You know, there's so many different platforms, like streaming platforms, like with Townies and other stuff like that. But, you know, animation, since it takes so long and now they're not necessarily, you know, making it for those key networks, they don't have to follow that certain schedule. And it was only like a year ago that I learned like when networks, like normal networks like NBC or whatever, Fox, take their pitches, because I was just so used to anytime.
Cyclical, yeah. Yeah. But especially in digital, it's like, you know, you can pitch, shoot, and finish something in the amount of time that it takes
to paper a big boy show.
Oh, yeah. Can I say that I still have something in development at Warner Brothers that I sold before Townies?
Oh,
that, like,
most definitely.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's shelved now. I'm not sure when that moment happens, but it's kind of amazing how I've, like, pitched, written, and created and now distributed a whole
and
thing.
Doing PR for.
And doing PR for.
So when you're writing animation, is it different than writing live action?
A little bit. It's funny, I get that question a lot, especially at the lecture series that I do, because I think that people assume that there is, like, this great big wall between live action writing and animation writing. Surely, you know, because they're for completely different audiences. But, you know, first of all, writing is writing is writing. So when you're breaking a story, it's, you know, completely the same as, say, if you were breaking a live action story. The only thing that I would say that is starkly different with animation writing is there's just a whole new set of rules, right? Mm-hmm. So there are different terminology that gets kind of batted around, where it's like mimicable behavior is a thing that you kind of have to watch out for. The notes that you get are a little bit more sure. Like, do kids understand this? And we always fight the fight of, like, can we teach them?
Right. Mimicable behavior, though, it means, like, are you going to watch this cartoon and then, you know, strangle your little brother because
exactly.
you saw Batman do it?
Yeah. I don't know if I ever told you this, and it may surprise you, but I have written for a couple of preschool things.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I did that. And it was some of the hardest writing that I've ever had to do just because of all the rules. Mm-hmm. One of the shows that I was working on had, like, a fire hydrant character. It was like a puppet. It's a Sid and Marty Krofft show, so it was kind of psychedelic and fun. But I got a note where I made some joke about, like, a firefighter being related to this puppet of a fire hydrant. And the note was, don't reference fires in your scripts.
You can reference,
and I was
putting,
like,
out fires, but
huh,
fires.
You know, and so then it was like, okay, so, like, what jokes are we gonna write for this puppet? Can we do the dog almost
right.
peeing on the puppet every time? The answer is yes.
Oh, cool.
Cool. So there was know, that was evergreen. But mimical behavior was, like, really, really strong in writing for preschool. But back to writing for animation, just keeping in mind, you know, those kind of things. And also, I think what people don't realize is animation has a production budget very similar to live action. So something I've actually learned a lot through my husband, Mike, I'll say his full name, Mike Mayfield. People are fans. He works a lot in Adult Swim stuff, but he would tell me, hey, don't write town hall scenes.
like where there's 1,000 people.
Yeah.
Hey, don't write train chases, you know?
What about, like, 10 people around a table?
If they are pre-existing in that world and the design is there, yes.
Sure. There you
yeah,
go.
So you kind of have to keep in mind that. That's not something that I necessarily have to think about in my day-to-day on my current job, but, you know, one of our EPs comes from animation, and so he is usually, like, the voice of reason of, like, this is going to be real expensive. And we're like, okay.
Yeah. You have to mean it with this scene.
Exactly. Yeah. Because I think that people assume, well, dinosaurs can skateboard, so why can't I fucking, like, anything's possible in animation. Right. But there's still limitations in that way. And then the only other thing that I would say is, like, when I'm writing animation versus live action, I probably use more exclamation points. Which is, like, a silly
true thing. I don't
know.
I doubt that.
Yeah, that's probably not true. But, I mean, there is a slight formatting difference where for sound effects, you cap and carrot them. And, you know, you have to kind of make sure that the board artists know how to interpret, you know, much like a director reading a script like yourself, man. And trying to interpret, you know, what you need to do. You have to really spell out everything. Because I've gotten notes on, like, okay, like, you say it's a tin of cookies. Like, and then, like, what does it look like with this and that? And it's not necessarily that I have to spell out the physics of something in such, like, an nth degree. But to just be as clear as possible so that, you know, when I see the animatic, it's, you know, I wrote a scene about a, let's go back, skateboarding dinosaur. I then see it later and they're roller skating and I go, no, that changes everything. I'm sorry. I quit.
Yeah, yeah. The dinosaur has an attitude.
Flip the table.
He's a cool dude. He's not a douche dude.
Yeah. Come on. Hey, I like to roller skate.
It's coming back. Well, you know, it's funny. I remember with Townies when I realized, like, oh, you have an animation background. It did actually unlock things a little bit for me. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, these are kind of all Simpsons jokes in a certain sense of like, okay, like we're dealing with archetypes and, you know, like the world is more flexible than it like a grounded sort of style show. And it kind of informed the way that we got to move the camera a little bit more, you know, like that would be the thing I think that would change actually is if we had more time is that I'd have some drone shots.
Yeah, I know. Every time I see... Because when we were on the set, we were so excited for the drone shot. And every time I see a drone shot now, I'm like, Matt!
Oren bought a drone.
Oh!
we gotta go do it. That was the one where we literally had the drone on set and couldn't do
it. Next time.
Yeah. We should probably wrap up, but I want to... Just speaking of The Simpsons real quick, you have a podcast.
Yes.
About The Simpsons.
Yes.
What's it called?
Everything's Coming Up Simpsons.
And it's super popular.
I guess. I don't know. we were on Feral Audio for a little while, and then we're joining another podcast network soon. But Allie and I, my co-host Allie Gertz and I, we've been doing it for about 2 or 3 years, and we've had the great fortune of, you know, like actual Simpsons people on as guests. We've had former showrunners like Josh Weinstein and Bill Oakley, Mike Scully. We've had Dana Gould on, Tim Long. We had Weird Al on, and that was cool. Super fun.
That's pretty excellent.
Yeah, he came over. That was when we were still recording at my house, and he came over early, and it was just me and Weird Al in my kitchen
for
10 whole minutes. I think I offered him a Zevia, and he took it.
Wait, what is a Zevia? I don't think
I know. Oh, it's a stevia soda. A stevia sweetened soda.
Because he's a pretty healthy guy.
He's a vegan, too. And that was actually, like, my opening line to him because my husband's show, Mr. Pickles, they had an episode about vegans, and they wanted an all-vegan voice cast. So they brought him in, and then
Are you serious? They wanted an all-vegan voice cast?
Yeah, for, like, everyone, all the guest stars. That was just like a little Easter egg that they wanted to do.
As a little joke.
That's cool.
Yeah, as a little joke. So then I got to voice a waitress at the end of the episode.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I got to like open with that when he came over. I was like, oh, we were in the same episode of Mr. Pickles. And I think he just went, cool. I was like, okay. He's
like,
Zevia? Well, I also got to tell him we had just seen him in concert in Vegas on his Mandatory Fun tour.
Oh, fun.
And so I told him that when it was at Planet Hollywood Casino in Vegas, and all we did was step onto the main floor, just being ourselves. And everyone, it seemed, knew exactly why we were there and pointed us in the direction of the Weird Al concert.
Weird Al shows that way. Yeah.
And I told him that. I was like, I don't know what. And he goes, I guess I have a type.
Boy, do you.
Weird Al was my first concert.
Really?
Yeah. Really? Oh, mm-hmm. It's a good time.
At the Orange County Sawdust Festival.
Yeah.
Cool.
State Fairs. Yeah.
He puts on such a good show.
Yeah, yeah, he had that fat suit.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, what I love about him is that, like, I also grew up going to, like, Aquabat shows and, like, all of those kind of gimmick band shows because I was a theater kid.
Sure.
And, like, that's, and it was a safe area. Punk was too scary.
Yeah. Are you from Orange County?
No, I'm from North Hollywood, but I spent, like, all of my high school youth in Orange County going to ska shows.
Reversal, right? You're I live in Los Angeles.
Yep. And then
you're going to drive to the suburbs.
Oh, yeah. And
I'm going to go to college.
Ooh.
I took the bus for 2 hours. It was the Disneyland bus from downtown.
Uh-huh.
I had an Orange County boyfriend who would pick me up at the Disneyland bus terminal. And we would just hang out for the weekend. And then I would zip back up. Then cut to going to college in Orange County. I did the reversal because I started doing stand-up.
Right.
So I would peace out every weekend and be like, I'm going to go to L.A.
Yeah, yeah.
Fuck it. So now I have 3 friends from college because I just never got around. I didn't want to know anybody.
Yeah, no.
I was done
by
the time I got there. But anyway.
Well, closing question. You were in a ska band as a kid? No.
I was in a bunch of fake ska bands.
Fake ska bands.
I'm
trying to remember. I love knowing a ska band name.
Yeah.
Did you have a...
Am I misremembering? Did you have a funny ska band name?
We were called the P.S. Andes after Pea Soup Andersons.
Okay.
That's pretty cool. Good.
And we got as far as taking our band photos.
Yeah.
And that's Pea Soup favorite. Andersons is an amazing, world famous pea soup restaurant.
I was into Real Big Fish was a big band for me. Yeah. There's another band called Codename Rocky I really like.
I mean, No Doubt had ska.
Oh, influence, early on especially, yeah.
Well, bringing it back home, yes. I am actually going to say that I started listening to Less Than Jake specifically when I was trying to like write some stuff about being a young person again, because that was what I was listening to when I was a kid. And it really did kind of bring back ideas and themes and emotions that I'd had back then, and was like pretty powerful in a funny way, even though like I don't listen to that music regularly now, but the magic of Spotify, you can kind of like unlock some emotional stuff. And I think thinking about revisiting the music of your youth that you were too cool for now is interesting.
Yeah I've been doing that a little bit with a little bit of the ska stuff. Like I listened to RX Bandits the other day and was like, holy shit.
You're like, okay, I feel this.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Yeah it's back in there. You realize those bands were kind of bad and like love them a little bit more for it.
Yeah And the sense memory of that is like really, really like strong and intoxicating. Yeah I love that.
Yeah,
I listened to Four Non Blondes the other day. I had a similar experience.
Really?
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, but it is, I mean, that I didn't think about it in like what you just said, where like, oh, listen to music from different times in your life to try to channel different times in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was just doing scents. I was like, what deodorant did I wear back then? Axe body spray. Yes, I remember high school.
But music is so important to kind of bring it back to writing and the writing process. Like music is so important to, you know, getting into the zone of a certain time and place when you're writing too. And I love that question asking like writers, like, what did you listen to when you wrote this? Like there are some, and this is going to come as no surprise to you, Matt. But there are some scripts that I've written where I like listened to a bunch of like 1980s training montage songs and mixes.
Yeah. We might have a couple in townies.
Yeah.
How many training montage? Oh no, we have one, but we intersplice between all the characters.
Yeah, I love a good training montage. I just think they're so funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I think that, you know, that's really important just to sort of like get in the zone of it. And you know, you're like really cooking when your like head is bobbing and you're like, you know, it's like you're making your own training montage of writing a script of getting in the zone.
Can you write while you're listening to music with lyrics?
Yes and no. It depends. If it's like the lyrics are really loud and kind of interrupt, then maybe not. Lately, I've been kind of a pretentious asshole and listening to like 60s jazz.
Oh, that's fun, right? I listen to a lot of Godspeed, You Black Emperor, and Ratatat are like my two.
Oh, Ratatat's great.
Yeah. Ratatat. That was going to be my endorsement, actually. Yeah. It's like, because it's nonverbal, but also like, I maybe have even endorsed them already.
I don't think you have.
But it's like really driving and funky and fun, you know? It's good.
Off of that, I will recommend Currents by Tame Impala. I think that's the name of the album. Yeah. But the lead is Tame Impala album. Yeah. When it first came out, I remember listening to it on a loop for like hours writing, because it's just like in that same Ratatat kind of way. It just is like nice and progresses you.
Well, I will check all that stuff out.
Yeah.
So, should we jump into our unpaid endorsements?
We're naturally segueing into unpaid endorsements.
Mm-hmm.
Unpaid endorsements.
Julia, you got anything?
I watched a Netflix series the other day. The End of the Fucking World. Have you heard of it?
I've canceled Netflix.
Really?
What? And,
yeah. Because I was like, oh, I'm just not watching this at all. I'll get it again later. Like, but I'll save myself $15 for a month or two and then like four different things have come up where I'm like, fuck, I really want to watch this.
It's really good.
The End of the Fucking World. Yeah, it's really like good.
Teenage British Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh, yeah. It's British?
Mm-hmm.
It looks kind of like a lot of movies that I feel like have been made, like that Steve Carell one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
with Keira Knightley.
Oh, yeah, like Seeking a Friend at the End of the World.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's very different. This is in the trailer, so I don't feel like I'm spoiling anything, but do you watch Black Mirror at all?
Yeah.
I haven't seen
the new season.
Do you
remember that episode, Shut Up and Dance, with that kid who, like...
I haven't seen that one.
Well, he's in that one, too. He's this great young British actor, but the trailer opens and the series opens where it's his narration, and he says, like, this is my name, you know, this is where I grew up, blah, blah, blah. I'm pretty sure I'm a psychopath and I can't help it. And then he just sort of goes through his, like, childhood. He's like, I couldn't help killing all these animals. Here are all the animals that I killed. And now all I want to do is, like, kill something bigger. So now I'm trying to find who I'm going to kill. And so that's where it starts. And then it zags around. And then, you know, a girl character is introduced and we hear her narration. It's great. I, like, was sad when it was over. I haven't felt that way about a show in a really long time.
How long did it take you to watch it?
Oh, no time at all.
Yeah, because I had friends who were like, oh, we watched literally the whole thing in one sitting without planning on it.
Yeah, well, here's the thing that's really interesting is that, and this is, like, great about streaming, some episodes were, like, 15 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And some episodes were standard length, but it kind of just, like, dictated what it wanted to do. Like, we don't need to tell the story in any more time. Here you go. But I think that it took like 2 days just because we had other things going on. But I was really upset. And it feels pretty open-ended. It feels like there's going to be more. So
I think it's based off of a graphic novel.
That's what I heard. Yeah.
I will check it out.
End of the fucking world.
End of the fucking world. And like, it should be on the main page. But yeah, just type that in. And when you look at the title, it's like UNC are starred.
Yeah, yeah.
Bleh, whatever. I have that to recommend. And then I also, another Netflix show that I just find delightful that plays in the background of things and makes me feel good things. Somebody Feed Phil, the Phil Rosenthal travel show. The guy who created Everybody Loves Raymond. It's basically doing his Bourdain.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's just such a delightful human and feels very present. Sometimes you watch a reality show and you just can tell that they're hosting. But he just feels very, like, engaged. And I enjoy the shit out of it.
Ah, that sounds pretty good.
It's pretty nice.
Yeah, it hasn't even been a month. I was like, I'm going to wait a month before I get Netflix again.
Because they're releasing stuff every day.
Yeah. Oren, you got anything, bud?
Did I talk about the T-Mobile trick for free Wi-Fi on airplanes?
No. What is that?
It's probably not super legal, but... bring it up. So, kind of been flying a lot lately, and there's GoGo in-flight internet.
Yeah.
It's like not on Southwest, but on a lot of other airlines. Southwest, by the way, is $8 for internet. It's pretty cheap. Doesn't matter how long your flight is. Just remember, if you're going to get the internet, just get it right at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Because I'm always like about to land in half an hour. I was like, oh, I could really use internet right now. And it's like, I'm not going to pay the whole price. But anyway, if there's GoGo in-flight internet on your airplane, it's free if you have T-Mobile.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for those of us, including me, that don't have T-Mobile, ask your friends what, you know, carrier they have and try to mark in your phone which of your friends has T-Mobile because if you just put in their phone number into the login screen, you get free internet.
Oh, there you go, man.
Yeah.
So you just have to find a couple friendships.
Sure.
I mean, I don't think, unless they happen to be flying at the same time.
Yeah, what are the odds?
Yeah.
I don't think, no friendships. I start with phone numbers of friends and are more like acquaintances.
Oh, do you just try and randomly enter them in or?
Well, I went on this bachelor party trip with a bunch of guys to Montreal and they all had free international calling. I was like, how do you have free international calling? They're like, oh, T-Mobile, like Canada, Mexico, all North America is free. And so I basically found out I have this big list of guys that have T-Mobile.
Oh, I'm just going to hit you up for one of their phone numbers. How about that?
Well, the problem is you always, like, I bet the most Googled thing on an airplane is like, how do you get free Wi-Fi on an airplane? Except you don't have internet when you do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the problem. It's like you'll think of hitting me up while you're in an airplane.
Right. You just have to do it in
advance.
You won't
be able to contact me.
You have to save it in your notes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the real endorsement is email your friends right now, everyone.
Yeah. And I don't think you should tell them. They probably won't be into it.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what difference does it make to them? But like, it's just a mental thing of like,
Has anyone ever like texted you and said like, hey, what's your Netflix password? Can I use it real quick? Have you guys shared your login info with anyone?
No.
No.
Oh, wow.
I have had ex-boyfriends use an HBO Go password like well beyond the statute of limitations and have my mom get very angry at them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because every time I start Boardwalk Empire, it's at a different part.
Yeah, that is frustrating. I used my brother's sister-in-law's HBO Go password for way too long.
Yeah.
We were watching.
It's easy to do it and then forget.
Yeah. We were watching The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu. We pay for everything except for Hulu. For Hulu, we used a friend's account, and she canceled it like halfway through the season. And we were like,
what are we gonna do?
I was like, Carrie, you call, like, to my wife, like, you call her and ask her if, like, they changed the password or something. Yeah. It's a rough life we live.
I know. These are real problems.
Enlo?
Yeah. So mine is, this is a little bit of a thing that I should have thought of a long time ago, but, so on Google Calendar, you can have it like set to like add any sort of calendar you want. So like different holidays and stuff is pretty standard. And I feel like I never thought to put non-US holidays on my calendar, but so I added like the Jewish holidays to the calendar because I constantly was like accidentally scheduling things on holidays that I wasn't aware of. And I was like, oh, like I feel like we've recorded like podcast episodes on holidays. And then you're like, yo, dude, just so you know. And like, it's like an easy, stupid thing to do. Like, it literally takes 5 seconds. Yeah. And then, you know, at the very least, you're more informed.
I love that tip.
I don't think there's been a Yom Kippur in the last 10 days when someone hasn't been like, we're doing reshoots on this day.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I will probably pass out halfway through the day.
Yeah.
Because I'm not eating, just so you know. I have passed out.
Have you really?
Yeah. And this is probably way too much information for a podcast. But I was doing a sound mix for my movie on Yom Kippur, and I basically passed out, and they brought all this Chinese food, and they're like, you have to eat. They made me like eat this noodle soup, and then I like threw up, but I had to throw up, and I just like ran outside and threw up in the yard of the sound mixer's house, and then his dog ate it,
and then he
came inside his living room, the main house, not his studio, and he threw up on the floor, and they had to like change the carpeting, and the sound mixer got so mad at me. He's like, why'd you throw up in my yard? I was like, where else am I supposed to throw up? In your sound mixing like studio?
I
don't know.
Also, any port in the storm, like when you're about to
grow up,
like, come on.
Anyway,
yeah.
Too much information. Sorry.
I don't know. I kind of love that
story. Pretty good. It's pretty good. Well, Julia, on that note, where can people find out more about you?
I am at Julia Prescott on all the things. That includes Twitter and Instagram and all
Prescott,
that.
Prescott, two T's?
Yes, two T's. I guess I have a website, juliaprescott.com, that I barely update. And if you like The Simpsons, listen to my podcast, Everything's Coming Up Simpsons. We are all of our episodes are on iTunes. You can find us there. And
how many episodes are there?
Oof, that's a good question.
Like over 100?
Over 100, I think. Yeah.
Can people dive in like in the last 10 episodes?
Yeah. I mean, the way the format is the guest brings their favorite episode of The Simpsons, and we kind of break it down and talk about like why they love it and, you know, explore the themes, what, you know, The Simpsons does really well, which is like we talk about different kinds of jokes that they do weave together pretty seamlessly, like highbrow, lowbrow, you know, Gore Vidal reference right next to man getting hit in the crotch with football, right. That kind of stuff. And we have a good time.
Do you have repeat episodes?
We have recently, because we took a holiday break, we like repeated some of our best of. So
have you ever done the same episode,
sorry.
Simpsons episode twice?
Not yet. And we're kind of, there's a lot of episodes to choose from. So we've kind of like told people like good news, bad news. Hey, we want you on the show. Bad news. Like,
here's the list
episode.
That you're getting.
The only, like, we're saving certain episodes for our like dream guests. So we're going to save Monorail for Conan and like other bullshit like that.
Yeah.
Which this world is crazy. We got Weird Al on. So it could happen.
Most of the voice cast, right?
Or we just had Nancy Cartwright on.
Oh,
which
I thought
was,
there was more than that.
No, we're
Nancy
actually,
Cartwright. What a treat.
I know, what a treat. And she was so sweet and like blew our minds by saying she actually listens to our podcast, which doesn't feel like it's right. She told us also, God, Matt Groening was the one to recommend our podcast.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Pretty cool.
So I'm going to die tomorrow and be happy. But sorry
about
Sorry about dying. Yeah. No, I'll be blissed out. It'll be great.
Yeah. What a way
I
to
think
go.
In the near future, we're going to be really trying to get more of that voice cast, like Tress MacNeille and, you know, Pamela Hayden and all these different people to come on and talk about their experience, because, you know, they have a very different experience mm-hmm. in working on the show than the writers do. And I think that that's like really interesting and valid too. And then other like comedians that you know and love talking about bullshit.
Yeah, so. Cool. Yeah. So the thing I like about that is that you can search by either your favorite episode or by a comic you like.
Hey, it's a twofer.
That's pretty nice.
It's a spicy twicey.
Cool. Who did the Lisa Vegetarian episode?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if we've done that one yet.
Yeah, you have.
Oh,
We have. I'm sure you have, because that's the one.
It was a while ago.
We've talked about that's the reason I became vegetarian.
Yeah.
Because of that episode, not because of the podcast episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. We won awards with that podcast episode. Yeah. Yeah, gosh, I'm so sorry to the person who did have that. I'm going to have to correct on Twitter. But that actually comes up a lot because both Allie and I, my co-host, are vegan. So whenever we have like another vegetarian vegan person, they usually say it's because of Lisa the Vegetarian that kind of opened their eyes. And that's the thing that's really great about that show, too, is that like it's just so much better than it needed to be.
Sure.
You know, it was just needing to be a primetime comedy. And yet it like approached all of these different concepts of like religion and like, you know, sort of society in a way that had never been seen, not only through the animation scope, but for, you know, any TV show in primetime. Right. And to have a whole story that is like centering around a young girl character becoming vegetarian and what that means for the people that choose not to be vegetarian and how that's okay too. Like they're very accepting in all of the different perspectives. You never feel like they're judging one certain way. Kind of similar, but very different than how South Park approaches their egalitarian, everybody sucks way.
Right.
The Simpsons is a little bit more kind and soft with that. But yeah, I love like their impact in that way, not just culturally, but, you know, with people that are making lifestyle choices.
Yeah.
And you still watch new episodes?
I don't watch a ton. It's not like I'm sitting in front of the TV every Sunday. I haven't done that for a while. But in writing this book that Ellie and I are writing for like the 100 Things series for super fans of things. Was that a good explanation?
Yeah, I think we get it.
I was watching
Urban
way more.
Outfitters. I'm waiting for my wife to finish changing.
Yeah,
and
100
trying
things.
Something
yeah,
on.
Exactly.
Oh yeah, perfect.
This is the boyfriend waiting book. And
what
the
if
airport.
You just get? Ooh, yeah. People don't realize you wrote it, and you just keep getting copies of this. I saw
oh,
this book.
Man.
I thought of you.
Yeah,
I really
yes,
hope that'll
that would,
happen.
Oh my god, that'd be
oh,
so
that'd be
funny.
So good.
That'd be so funny. I'm sure some parent is not going to read our name on it and be like, "I thought you would love this."
Genuinely, it would be an easy mistake to make.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh man, I really hope
that.
I
wrote
I will
the
text
book
you.
On that.
I will text you both. But yeah, in writing this book, I've FX has this really great app where like streaming on, I think only Apple TV, but you go in there and you click on Simpsons World and you can shuffle any episode throughout its 29, 28 seasons. So yeah. You know, statistically, most of it's going to be newer episodes that mm-hmm. are post season 10, which is where a lot of people put the cutoff for the golden age. So I've just like watched a ton of newer ones, you mm-hmm. know, through that. And it's been actually kind of nice to not sit and make the active choice of like a season 17 episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And to kind
totally.
Of be surprised by it.
That's cool. That's
yeah.
really nice.
Yeah, highly. That's my other unpaid endorsement.
There we go.
Cool.
I think I have like 7.
Well, you can find out more about these endorsements on our website at justshootitpodcast.com. You can also email us, justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can leave us a review on iTunes, like us on Facebook, interact with us. We love it all. Let us know what you think about Julia Prescott.
Leave us a voicemail if you have a question that's a little lengthier and you want us to talk about it on the show. Give us a call at 2626-SHOOT-1. We love those voicemails. Can't wait to hear them. And you can follow me on Twitter at Mr. Matt Enloe.
And me at Smitey Pyleg. And this episode was edited by Jay McAuliffe. And our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And the music you're listening to is by the artist Jazar from the Free Music Archive. And we will catch you next week.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.